Guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasant duty to extend to all of you, on behalf of the Australian Government and the Department of Supply, a very warm welcome to this important occasion. We are honoured that the Prime Minister is able to be with us today to officially open the 64-metre antenna, which is tangible evidence of the cooperation existing between the United States of America and Australia. We also have with us Dr. James C. Fletcher and Mrs. Fletcher. Dr. Fletcher is the presidentially appointed administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, as it has come to be universally known. Dr. Fletcher, we are especially honoured that you have chosen to personally represent NASA at this first dedication of a NASA facility in Australia by the Australian Government. This is the only dedication in Australia that an administrator of NASA has attended. The Associate Administrator of NASA, Mr. Gerald Trzynski, is present, and also Dr. William Pickering and Mrs. Pickering. Dr. Pickering is the Director of the Jet Propulsion Authority, which on behalf of NASA is responsible for the systems management and technical direction of the Deep Space Network, of which this new antenna is a vital part. I extend to each of these visitors to Australia our warmest welcome. The 64-metre antenna is to be known as Deep Space Station 43, with the identifying name of Balima, Aboriginal for very far away, which we believe to be symbolic of both its location in this country and its role in deep space tracking. The Department of Supply is responsible for the performance of this and other NASA stations here, but Australian industry plays a vital part in their staffing and operation. The contract for operational and maintenance services at Tidenbilla is held by Amalgamated Wireless Australasia Limited, and I am pleased that the company's managing director, Mr. John Hook, is with us today. Construction of this antenna has entailed a great deal of planning, hard work and skill, involving many branches of the engineering and allied professions. The prime contractor was Collins Radio Company of Dallas, Texas, whose basic task was to fabricate the antenna in the United States, ship it to Australia, and arrange its erection. I would mention the considerable use made by Collins of Australian workers on site here, and also the extensive use of local materials, such as the concrete pedestal, including the steel reinforcing, the steel fabricated revolving staircase, much of the piping on the antenna, and all of the painting. The Australian Department of Works, in consultation with engineers from the Department of Supply and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, planned the modification of the existing instrumentation, the air and power generation station, and other facilities to meet the requirements of the new antenna. The detailed design was completed by the Department of Works, and the prime construction contract is awarded to the Bookman Building Group. The staff at Tidenbilla have participated significantly in the commissioning of the antenna with the installation and testing of electronics. My thanks go to all the people and organisations involved in bringing this antenna to a state of operational readiness. I am proud to be associated with the opening of the antenna, a facility which will be instrumental in pushing back the frontiers of space and opening its mysteries to mankind. Sir, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome all present on this important occasion.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now present the Prime Minister of Australia, the Honourable E.G. Whitlam. Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Administrator, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen.
This is one American facility on Australian soil whose general purposes and possible consequences I am only too happy to proclaim. I assure you, they are wholly benign. We have no belligerent intentions towards Venus, Mercury, or Mars. Our diplomatic relations with the remote regions of the solar system are thoroughly cordial. I'm sure our American guests will confirm that assessment. So too will my colleague, my deputy, Mr. Barnard. It is certainly an honour to welcome to Australia so many distinguished leaders of the American space program. Dr. Fletcher, Mr. Tuzinski, Dr. Pickering, represent and administer a unique example of American enterprise and idealism. The space program has few counterparts. It is difficult to think of another enterprise on such a scale in any country applying such massive reserves of skill, technology, and public funds, which is wholly dedicated to peaceful causes and the disinterested pursuit of knowledge. NASA was established by Act of Congress in 1958. That act proclaimed that activities in space should be devoted to peaceful purposes for the benefits of mankind. 15 years later, the American space program remains the foremost example of a major scientific and technological endeavor without obvious military or ideological overtones. Tidbinbilla is one of 7 space communication facilities in Australia managed on behalf of NASA. This is the largest complex of NASA installations outside the United States herself. It is a matter of great pride for Australians that we are so closely involved in this historic program of research and exploration. The opening of this antenna comes at a time when the US is shifting its emphasis from manned space flight, typified by Apollo, to the use of unmanned spacecraft for more practical and economical studies of space phenomena. This antenna will play an important role in that research. It will track and communicate with vehicles at the limits of the solar system. It is, I'm informed, the most advanced instrument of its kind in the world. In Australia, we are familiar with the role that Tidbinbilla, Carnarvon, Honeysuckle Creek have played in the Apollo project. These names have become household words. I think all Australians recognise the increasing importance of space activity. For Australia, there are special benefits to be gained from this installation. It is gratifying that Australian scientists will have access to the antenna for conducting their own independent studies in radio astronomy. We shall have access to all scientific data acquired by US space projects, together with more practical everyday information from weather and communication satellites. It's now clear that there are many practical and technical applications of space activity that were not apparent in the early days, when the space race appeared as a costly and flamboyant manifestation of Cold War rivalries. Space activity, like aviation, is now a familiar part of our lives. It has immense value in many fields. I mention a few: communications, broadcasting, navigation, surveillance and traffic control of ships and aircraft, general scientific research. It's also proving useful as a means of monitoring and surveying the Earth's resources, its forests, minerals, marine life, water, vegetation. As such, it may become one of the principal tools for conserving and protecting the natural environment. The truly heartening aspect of modern space research is its increasingly international and non-political character. It is no longer dominated by the rivalries and animosities, or indeed the perils, of the arms race. I'm told that outside the US, the 2 other principal space tracking stations in the network to which this one belongs are in Johannesburg and Madrid. I assure you there are few international arrangements in which my government can boast of its links with Spain and South Africa. I'm happy to see that the distinguished ambassadors of both countries are here today. Space, indeed, conquers all barriers. If I may quote the words of a distinguished Australian, Sir Mark Oliphant, to an international science school at Sydney University, science and technology have become perhaps the most important avenues of cooperation and understanding within the whole human family. I believe that's true. Space is one field in which there can be no national boundaries or territorial claims. It's open to all nations and peoples for scientific exploration. The reaches of space are the high seas of the modern navigator. This principle of free international access has been recognized in regions such as the Antarctic, where military and nuclear activities are proscribed by international treaty. The major powers have also agreed that outer space shall not be used for military purposes. This installation therefore symbolizes a common human resolve that space research is preeminently a field for peaceful international cooperation in which all nations have a right to participate. Perhaps the most spectacular example of international cooperation in space will be the joint American-Russian mission, which is planned for mid-1975, involving the rendezvous and docking of Apollo and Soyuz spacecraft. And today, we have not only the United States ambassador, but the USSR ambassador at the dedication of this complex. We often hear people complain that the space program isn't worth the money. Even now, with a reduced budget, NASA's estimates for the fiscal year 1974 are for an expenditure of more than $3 billion. There are times when I'm relieved that Australia has no space program of her own. But whatever cost-benefit test we may apply, one thing is clear. Space exploration has been a human adventure of the noblest and most ambitious kind. Even those who have questioned the cost and the priorities accorded to it have been moved by its vision and its audacity, by its brilliant scientific and technological achievements, and by the courage of the astronauts themselves. There is much to be said for the view that the real justification of space exploration is to be found in its intangible rewards. It appeals to an ancient spirit of adventure. It satisfies man's needs to explore. It may help us to a better understanding of the nature and origins of the universe itself. Only the meanest and most limited imagination can remain unmoved by such appeals to our scientific curiosity and our capacity for wonder. I think the last time I spoke on these subjects was in November 1969 at an official Australian luncheon for the three American astronauts, Armstrong, Collins and Aldrin, who were the first men to visit the moon. They were kind enough to give me an autographed photograph of themselves standing on the moon's surface. I've not yet been able to return the courtesy, but one day perhaps we will have parliamentary delegations to the moon and the planets. Certainly much progress has been made in the last 3 years. The Apollo project has come to a triumphant conclusion with the successful Apollo 17 mission last December. We shall be honoured during this year's Coral Sea celebrations by the presence of Dr. Harrison Schmidt, who was a member of the Apollo 17 crew. May I interpolate here a tribute to this latest benefit which the retiring American ambassador has been able to produce to cement the relations between his country and ours. This may be one of the last public occasions which he will attend in his term in the Australian capital. He has done so much individually and collectively to make us understand and appreciate us better. I have no doubt that the space program has helped strengthen Australia's relationship with the United States and will continue to do so. I see this installation as a proud symbol of cooperation and friendship between our countries. I congratulate those who have planned and built it. I'm sure it will bring benefits to both our countries and knowledge and enlightenment to all the world. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud and pleased indeed. Now, to open and dedicate NASA's Deep Space Communications Complex in the Australian capital. Ballina is now open and dedicated.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now present Dr. James C. Fletcher, Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Mr. Prime Minister, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, Ambassador Rice, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a very great pleasure, but particularly a privilege to be invited to participate in the dedication of this most important facility, and perhaps more importantly, to be able to visit your country, with which NASA has had such a long and fruitful association. Much was said in the early days of the establishment of the global tracking and data network by NASA that it would not be possible to deal with foreign countries, that we ought to really set up our own tracking stations, much the same as the Soviet Union has done, that foreign cooperation throughout the world was next to an impossible task. But the leaders of NASA at that time, particularly because of their experience with Australia, their Australian people, the Australian government, knew that this could be done, particularly with Australia as an example. Perhaps it is not so well known that much of the tracking stations in our country were patterned after some of the work that was done early on in this country. Australia scientists were leaders or pioneers in the field of radio astronomy, and in 1960 they built the Parkes antenna, which if those of you who have seen it would think it was the same as this one. It is a 64-meter dish, as we say, much the same as, I guess approximately the same, but some say exactly the same as this one in dimensions. And that was in 1960, built under the supervision of your Dr. E.G. Bowen. It was perhaps this example that led the JPL scientists to design the first U.S. Tracking antenna in Goldstone, California, out in the Mojave Desert, which was primarily designed to track spacecraft that were headed for the distant planets. But as it turned out, Goldstone was an almost indispensable asset in connection with the Apollo program. Also in connection with the Apollo program, the Parkes antenna was on hand to give us a lift when we needed it in critical periods, particularly the ones that stand out most in people's minds in the U.S. was during the landing of Apollo 11. The Parkes antenna contributed very greatly to that program. We needed to have the data back, even though our antenna happened to be on the wrong side of the Earth from the Moon, and the Parkes people came in and supplied that need. Perhaps more importantly, at least to three individuals that I know, was its help in the return of the Apollo 13 spacecraft, which was a very near tragedy when we almost lost three astronauts. But again, when we needed the data, Johnny on the spot was the Parkes antenna, who pitched in on an emergency basis. And when we were unable to track because the Earth was in the way, they were able to supply that vital data to bring these three astronauts safely home. I think it might be interesting to you to describe, not in detail, but in what we call once-over lightly manner. What this particular antenna is going to be doing for the next several years. At the moment, as you probably know, it is busy tracking the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft. Pioneer 10 and 11 were launched towards the planet Jupiter, not the farthest out of the planets, but certainly the farthest out that man has ever been able to perceive. Apollo 10 was launched just about a year ago and is about 400 million miles away. And those of you that came early may have noticed the 64-meter dish pointed about in that direction. It was busy tracking the Pioneer 10 spacecraft 400 million miles away. It quit tracking only because we wanted it to be facing you during this ceremony. At the present time, however, the smaller dish over to your left is tracking the Pioneer 10 spacecraft, not with the same data rate, not with the same efficiency, but while this one is unoccupied, that one is still keeping track of the Pioneer 10. It's about in that direction right behind you. In December of this year, Pioneer 10 will fly past Jupiter, and we will get important imagery, pictures, and scientific data about that very distant, but also the largest of the planets in our solar system. And about a year from now, a little less, about 18 months from now, Pioneer 11 will also complete that journey. And what Pioneer 11 does will depend on how well we do with Pioneer 10. And it's ready to be reprogrammed one way or the other, depending on what happens as we encounter Jupiter this December. It might be interesting to you to comprehend that signals sent from this antenna up to the Pioneer spacecraft 400 million miles away, and a response back, which is the communication link, the only communication link to that spacecraft, takes about an hour and a half, or at least it will take an hour and a half when the spacecraft arrives at the planet Jupiter, traveling at the speed of light. So you can get some feeling for how far away this spacecraft can be tracked with this very large and efficient antenna. Moving along, however, in November of this year, we plan to launch another spacecraft, this time to the planet Venus, which is a much closer planet. And we will fly by Venus in much the same fashion as we fly by the planet Jupiter. But in this case, we will make use of the gravitational field of the planet Venus to whip us on to the planet Mercury. And the planet Mercury is also a planet which has never been before visited, arriving at Venus sometime next year and at Mercury sometime perhaps later in the year. In 1975, we will be launching two Viking missions. A Viking is a spacecraft designed to both orbit the planet Mars and later land. And you wonder, why do you want to land on a distant planet of that sort? The planet Mars, we are beginning to find out, is very likely, or certainly the most likely planet that we know of, to support life. Not life as we know it, but very elementary life. But it does have water, it does have the essential ingredients for life. And the purpose of this mission, at least in part, is to scrape and probe the surface of the planet with the landing vehicle, transmit the data back after analyzing the soil for minute organic and perhaps biological particles back to this antenna, where data will be processed at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And we will then know a lot more than we do about the planet Mars. With luck, we may, even on these two missions, find some evidences of life, or at least some evidences that life could be supported on that very important neighboring planet. After that, in 1977, we will launch two more spacecraft to the planet Jupiter. But this time, we will transmit back very precise images of the planet. And we will also take advantage of the gravitational field on this very large planet to proceed on to the planet Saturn. Saturn is the next most distant planet and the second largest planet in our solar system. Data from the Pioneer, which is now on its way, will be necessary to decide What should the orbit be of the Mariner, Saturn, Jupiter in 1977? There are some difficulties, unknowns about the planet Jupiter, which we must determine first from this important pioneer that's now on its way. So we have a very important program laid out for this seemingly large antenna, but certainly very precise and most sophisticated instrument. We're very happy for the cooperation that the Australian government, the Australian people have placed in the space program. In a way, it is an international program. All people have contributed. It's an important program in this sense that, as the Prime Minister mentioned, the peoples of the world can cooperate in a venture together without any territorial boundaries and with a real spirit of accomplishment in each country. I feel very much so after this visit to this country that Australia has played as an important role as any other country outside of the U.S. in the Apollo program itself. As an indication of this spirit of cooperation, I would like at this time, Mr. Prime Minister, to present a little reminder of this ceremony today. If you would step forward, please. The first reminder is an Australian flag that was carried on the last Apollo visit, Apollo 17, and it has this inscription: flag carried to the moon aboard the spaceship America, Apollo 17, December 6, 1972, to Prime Minister Whitlam in appreciation of the contributions of Australia to the space programs of the United States of America, signed by the three astronauts, Gene Cernan, Ron Evans, and it says Harrison Schmidt, his name is Jack, but they call him Jack, but he signs his name Harrison, and James Fletcher, Administrator of NASA.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we have one other memento, Mr. Prime Minister. I probably dwelt too long on the spacecraft called Pioneer, primarily because that is the spacecraft which this dish, this antenna, is now tracking, but maybe secondarily because we had a gift for the Prime Minister. This is a model, Mr. Prime Minister, of the Pioneer spacecraft. These are the power supplies at the edge. The instruments are behind the dish, and it says Pioneer Jupiter Space Probe, presented by Dr. James Fletcher, Administrator of NASA, to the Honorable E.G. Whitlam, QCMP, and you know what those initials stand for, Prime Minister of Australia, at the dedication of the DSS 43, April
13th, 1973. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister. Go ahead. And we have one other little memento that we would like to present to Deputy Prime Minister Barnard. You may, if the Deputy Prime Minister wishes, be able to see this later, but this is a large color photograph of the instrument before you, and its inscription says the following: Deep Space Station number 43, I hope I get this right, Tidbinbilla, ACT, presented by Dr. James Fletcher, Administrator of NASA, the Honorable Lance Barnard, MP, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, at the dedication April 13, 1973. It's a large one, but I think you'll find it very attractive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, there'll now be a demonstration of antenna movement. Now, as you'll see, the whole of the structure above the catwalk circling the concrete pedestal moves on the horizontal or azimuth plane. This structure, weighing some 2,300 tons, is supported on three steel pads with an extremely thin film of hydraulic oil between the pads and the runner plate beneath them. This film of oil, 0.2 millimeters thick, is the rotational bearing. At the same time, you'll observe the antenna main reflector and associated structures are gradually moving towards the upright or the zenith position. This motion is in the vertical or elevation plane. In this case, hydraulic motors located on the upper platforms drive pinions which mesh with the two larger gears attached to the elevation wheels. The large staircase, which is attached to the rotating structure and moving with it, provides access to the upper levels of the antenna. The rate of movement, both horizontally and vertically, is about 1/4 of a degree per second. And these rates are well in excess of those used in actual deep space tracking, where the antenna movement mainly compensates for Earth's rotation. Therefore, the antenna moves at about the same rate as the sun appears to move across the sky and in the same east-west direction. Now, we're not tracking. The main reflector is left in the upright position, as this offers the least wind resistance. However, such is the ruggedness of the construction that satisfactory tracking is possible in winds of up to 70 miles an hour. Now, the outer surface of the main reflector consists of aluminium plates drilled with thousands of small holes, which relieve the wind pressure that otherwise would build up over the near 1-acre area of the reflector. These holes do not interfere with the performance of the antenna. Horizontal rotation of 270 degrees is possible in either direction. In elevation, the main reflector can tip down to 6 degrees above horizontal, which is the position it was in at the start of this demonstration, up to the zenith position of 90 degrees. The combination of these two movements enables the antenna to point at any position in space. Now, and I have pleasure in reading messages received from the other 64-meter deep space station networks. From the 64-meter station DSS-14 at Galveston in California, welcome to the 64-meter network. We fully realize the tremendous effort required of you and your people to achieve the status of being operational for DSN operations. I'm certain DSS-43 will continue the tradition of providing high-quality data, which has for many years been the hallmark of the 26-meter Australia Deep Space Stations. And from the 64-meter station DSS-63 under construction at Madrid in Spain, we send our warm congratulations to you and all of your personnel on the day of dedication of the DSS-43 64-meter station. The efforts of all who worked so hard on this project are well understood here in Madrid. It will be our pleasure to soon join Tidbinbilla and Galveston in completing the 64-meter deep space network. We look forward to many handovers from Tidbinbilla to Madrid as we further the knowledge of mankind for the good of mankind in the international cooperative endeavors in space. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the official party will now make a tour of the operations building. Arrangements have been made for all guests to do likewise. Now, would you please note the color of the ribbon attached to the chair on which you are seated? Then associate yourselves with the guides will be on the roadway, who display the same colour ribbon on the lapel. Space is restricted inside the building, and I would ask your indulgence if there are any delays. The Minister requests the pleasure of your company at luncheon at the end of the tour of the station. Thank you very much.
Yeah.